This podcast is brought to you compliments of Kaspersky Lab, protecting more than 300 million systems worldwide against internet threats.
Welcome back to the Digital Underground podcast. This is one of what I hope is going to be a regular series of kind of news wrap-up podcasts I'm going to do with Mike Mimoso, my colleague at ThreatPost. And this happens to be, I think we picked a good week to start this, Mike, because we both just got back from Black Hat, just about a week ago. And, that's one of the biggest, probably the biggest conglomeration of researchers and, whoever else in the security community every year. Everybody seems to go out there now. I mean, I think they had, the Black Hat folks told me they had like 7,500 attendees this year. And that doesn't even count like press and, speakers and vendors and whoever else. It seems like there's about 10,000 people there.
Yeah, it was definitely pretty busy this year. And the show was, I think I got more out of the show than I definitely expected going in.
Yeah, well, I totally agree. When, some years you look at the schedule and you're like, oh man, this is going to be really good. Like this, this is a good talk, this is a good talk. And then you write about them beforehand and then you get there and you're like,
yeah.
There's really nothing else to write about here.
Yeah, it was different this year though, because a lot of the usual suspects weren't on the agenda. I mean, you didn't have a session from Kaminsky or Charlie Miller. A lot of those guys were absent. Either they didn't submit talks or their talks weren't accepted, and you got a lot of new blood. And I know you got to talk to one guy in particular that kind of nobody's ever heard of and blew a lot of people away with his presentation. And I got to meet a lot of new people too, and like I said, we definitely got a lot more out of it than I expected going in.
Yeah, it was good. And I think started with the the keynote on the first day, which was obviously the NSA director, Keith Alexander, and I honestly had no idea what to expect when we walked into that room. Like, it was, and that room was full. And this is anybody that has never been to Caesars or wasn't there, this is like four giant ballrooms, connected, and I would guess there was probably 5,000 people in that room, easily. It was standing room only, and he actually got like a pretty good ovation when he came on stage.
And he did, and he got another one during his talk. I don't exactly remember the point he made to generate the applause that he got, but it wasn't an entirely hostile crowd. I mean, there were a couple of points that were ugly that we've reported on and we can talk about, but just going in, I was shocked that he showed up. I mean, we talked about it a few weeks ago. It was 50-50 whether he was going to do it or not. So I guess he deserves some credit for that. He said a lot of things we expected, but he was also a little bit more forthright than I expected. He provided a lot of details, and he left a lot open to interpretation.
Yep.
So, you take it for what it was. He, give him credit for getting up there and facing a hostile or skeptical crowd, and, he came away okay.
Yeah, I think a lot of the sort of heckling and like booing and people shouting at him stuff maybe got overplayed because it was the most interesting part of the whole talk. But that was a relatively minor part of the whole thing.
Definitely.
I mean, it was like 40 or 45 minutes into this talk before any of that even happened. I give him a lot of credit for showing up there because that's it, going in, he knows almost no one in that room supports what his agency does,
right?
Essentially. Even before like any of these revelations, he wouldn't have gotten a great reception there just because, he runs an intelligence agency, and a lot of the folks in that audience don't, I don't know what they think intelligence agencies do, but
yeah.
They're not in favor of it. But I thought he held his own, and he was clearly tense and clearly sort of knew what he was in for. But it's sort of weird sitting there seeing the director of the NSA like put up the GUI for one of these collection tools that they use, which is kind of crazy, and sort of like showing slides describing how the NSA's collection programs work. 6 months ago, that would have been an insane you know.
Yeah, it was
idea.
It was an interesting gesture. I mean, you got a screenshot of basically what the records they collect look like in terms of phone metadata, the to and from, and the number and the duration of the call, stuff like that. And like you said, 6 months ago, that definitely would not have happened. So we're definitely seeing an about face from him and folks in the government. You know, it was interesting to see him up there. You're right. He was tense. He was guarded a little bit, but he offered a lot of detail in terms of the compliance that they have to go through internally, how stuff is audited. And, you know, you got to take that with a grain of salt too. Who's doing the auditing? That's a question he didn't answer. There are a lot of questions he didn't answer, left stuff up in the air. In terms of, I think at one point he said, we don't look at email, we don't look at stuff. Well, you collect it and you can look at it if you need to. So all of it was kind of, you know, left up to interpretation. And I think that's okay. It was, you know, that audience, you could do that. And the audience walked away understanding, you know, where he was coming from and knew how to interpret what he was saying and, you know, knew what was BS and what wasn't. So,
yeah. Yeah, I thought
it's not like he could get away. You know, he can get away with that on CNN and have the majority of the American public kind of, oh yeah, we're on your side. Well, it wouldn't work with this crowd.
Nope, not at all. And you know, and the whole Q&A thing. You know, it wasn't actually a Q&A. It was some pre-approved questions that I think were solicited from like attendees and maybe, you know, like Black Hat officials or whatever. It would have been nice to allow the general audience and, you know, even the media to ask some questions, but that's not really practical in that situation.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how you could have gotten that done.
Yeah, I mean, you're inviting ugliness, I suppose, at that point. I think that, you know, at the same time, that was kind of disappointing. I mean, one audience member did shout out a question that he answered, but it was such a lame question. I was like, boy, that's the opportunity you have, and that's what you can come up with. It's basically, why does Al-Qaeda hate us or something to that effect? I'm like, okay, really? But you know, otherwise, I mean, I think you're right in that situation. You know, I guess the Black Hat committee vetted some of the questions and proposed some of the stuff that was asked on stage. You know, otherwise, I mean, you know, there was a story about somebody was confiscated carrying some eggs into the right. into the keynote, which, you know, would have been a whole another level of ugliness if that had happened.
Yeah, and for people that weren't sitting up at the front, there were armed guards all over the place at the front of that room. If somebody had thrown an egg, it would have been a disaster.
Right.
I don't know what would have happened. It would not have been pretty.
Yeah, there were guys talking into their wrists the whole time. I was sitting in the second row or third row, and these guys were right in front of me, and it would not have been wise.
I got up, like, I was sitting next to you, and I moved up a couple rows to take some pictures, and those guys stared at me like I was, you know, if I had moved another 18 inches, like something, you know, I was getting carried out of there. I was like, okay.
The only guy that really scared me, though, was the one guy that had his shirt untucked, because you know what he had under his shirt, and he had to have it untucked.
Yeah. And I just don't, like, if they had open mics, you know, what were people going to ask? Like, I feel like it would have been like that Saturday Night Live skit with Chris Farley, like, you know, remember when you were in the Beatles? That was awesome.
Yeah.
It would have been like that, you know, like, why do you collect our stuff? Well, we don't.
Right.
But
it wouldn't have gone anywhere.
No.
It wouldn't have gone anywhere. It would have been awkward. It would have been uncomfortable. And
yeah, and anything you want to know is classified. He's not going to tell you what you want to know. Like, you already know way more than you're supposed to. Like, you're not even supposed to know any of this stuff. You know, it's only because of the leaks that you know you have any idea what's going on there.
And you know, he did it this year. I don't know if you're going to see another government guy get up there for a while, considering the environment. Probably not, but
no, I mean, I think this is a pretty big coup by Jeff Moss and Trey Ford to get that done. And, you know, I think they deserve a lot of credit for actually, you know, getting him on stage. I mean, I know that Jeff's been trying to get it done for years.
Yeah.
And, you know, this of all years, he actually gets the guy there. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
You know, that's not a small thing.
Yeah, they definitely scored on the timeliness factor, which is always good.
Yep, for sure. Okay, so aside from the Alexander madness, what would you say was like the the most interesting talk or, you know, storyline that that you came across out there?
I wrote about it the other day. I think it's just the general theme of the internet being broken. I mean, so many protocols, these guys are finding ways around. The breach attack being probably the most serious that it was one of the last sessions of the conference, and basically these guys broke SSL again. You know, poor SSL just keeps getting smashed and smashed. but just in general, just, you know, the session on where it was suggested that, you know, the RSA algorithm, you know, has a poor prognosis in terms of, you know, it could be years, it could be 10 years before it falls, but, you know, we need to get ready for that moment now. And probably the best session I saw was from the guys from White Hat Security, basically with a leveraged online ad networks to basically spread some JavaScript, and the JavaScript could be whatever they wanted, and there's no way to fix it according to them, because it's basically a problem with the design of the web, on an architectural level, and, you know, it's just impossible to fix without breaking so many other things that you know, you kind of throw your hands up at that point. So I think the web being broken was kind of the theme for me. I don't know about if you saw the same thing, but
I did. Yeah, you and I and a very well-known researcher were standing around talking about that one night out there, and it was funny because you always come away from Black Hat, especially thinking like, okay, I need to drop all of my computers into a vat of acid, you know, throw my cell phone off the Hoover Dam and just be done with all this because, you know, there's no hope for any of us. Like, everything is broken. And, you know, then people sort of bring you back to reality. But, you know, the guy we were talking to was like, oh, no. It's way worse than you think. Like, the web barely works.
Right.
Like, it's a miracle that anything works on the internet. Like, it's so badly put together, you know, everything is so fragile, it's completely ridiculous. And the attacks that you're seeing now, you know, like Breach and the stuff that Jeremiah and the White Hat guys did, he's like, this is, you know, this is really cool stuff, but there's a ton of stuff like that out there that you just don't know about, that you don't hear about, that, you know, if you put it all together, you would be like, oh my God. Or if you even saw like a little piece of it, you'd be like, holy crap, the internet is, you know, this thing is just going to fall over one day.
Right. And yeah, I don't know how these guys sleep at night, to be honest with you.
That's exactly right. It's like, I don't want to know this stuff on some level.
But it's funny, though, I asked that researcher that you're talking about, you know, whether he shops online and does online banking. He said, yeah, I mean, but
right, I know.
So I don't know which. But I guess it's all in, you know, these guys. You know, they're obviously on the right side of things. They're white hats, and they, you know, they have the right motivations. And, you know, you don't know what the bad guys are sitting on and what they're using it for. I mean, a lot of times they might have something that's really bad. It's just not economically feasible on their end to play with it. You know, they're making enough money stealing credit cards or whatever. It's just, you know, it's when that kind of turns on its head, then you might have a serious problem. So, but we're hearing it from the white hats, so.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're sitting on enough bad stuff. It makes me wonder what the bad guys have.
Oh, I know. Well, you know, the only thing that gives me any sort of hope is that, you know, some of the researchers are like, you know, the bad guys are so, as you just said, like, they don't even have to do this kind of research because there's so many pieces of low-hanging fruit.
Right.
That they're so busy, like, just gobbling that stuff up, they're not even bothering with a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like, most of these crews are just not even worried about, like, O'Day research or trying to break SSL or anything like that, because they're just, you know, there's just money falling out of the sky for those guys.
And you wonder how many of these guys are sitting in the audience, too, at Black Hat and DEF CON, just letting these guys do R&D for them.
A bunch.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure.
Yep. It's always been that way, yeah. I remember the first few DEF CONs I went to, like, you know, probably 10, 11 years ago, where it was much smaller and it was like at a miserable hotel off the strip. And you could tell, I mean, like there was only a few hundred people there, you know, and there was a clear divide, like who was who.
Yeah. You could tell who belonged and who didn't. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And it was a little weird, honestly. So, yeah, I mean, aside from, like, just the web being broken, like, the one other piece of that that I should mention is the story that I wrote. I spoke with this researcher, Paul Stone, whose name I had never heard before. None of the researchers that I spoke to had ever heard of him before either. He's, you know, from a small consultancy in the UK. And he just showed up and did this presentation that I think was towards the end of the day on, like, maybe Wednesday on the first day, called Pixel Perfect. And it was all about how he can, like, there was two pieces of it. One, sort of bringing back these JavaScript-based timing attacks and using some old, like, browser history sniffing tricks to see which sites you've been to and that kind of thing, which is, you know, that's worrisome for sure. But he also figured out this insane chain of timing attacks and weirdness with being able to use JavaScript and some other things to, like, blow up or tell whether a pixel in a person in an iframe on a person's browser is black or white, and then do that for each individual pixel in the iframe, and then recreate what's in that iframe, so that if you can, you know, force a site to be in an iframe, which is not that hard, then you can read the entire site. You can use the view source method to then see all the source code for the page that the person is on. So you could get all kinds of crazy stuff from that source code, depending on the page they're on. Like, if you're on Gmail or on Google Plus or something like that, you could get your Google ID, phone number, you know, physical address, that, all this kind of crazy stuff. And that kind of stuff is just unbelievable to me. Like, that, you know, any of that is even possible, and that anyone even figured it out.
I mean, I'm not sure I entirely understand it. I've read your story a couple of times and listened to explanations of it. But, you know, some of it's some old school stuff mixed in with, you know, some new work that he's done. And it's fascinating stuff. And it just to sit there, it would be kind of cool to sit there and watch him think this through and map it out, you know, as he's working. It probably takes months. But I can't imagine the process that these guys go through to, you know, well, if I do this, then what happens here? And then what happens here if I do this? It's just it must be something to watch and to document.
Yeah, well, he said it was sort of a series of little small discoveries. Like, you know, he started with that history sniffing stuff.
Right.
And then he discovered, like, if he, you know, used this special technique to really slow down the frame rate of, like, how a page renders, then he could tell when it was drawing the link, whether it was drawing the link as blue or purple, meaning, you know, unvisited versus visited. And so he could tell whether you had been to that site, and then infer a bunch of other information. And then from there, he was like, oh, well, what if I, you know, applied this kind of timing attack to this, and then the pixel thing came, and then, you know, the view source thing came, and it was just, you know, this sort of builds on itself. But, you know, bad thing about that is there's not really any way to fix stuff that he found. Like, there's no, you know, without some major architectural changes.
Right. That's the underlying problem with all of this stuff. It's just there's no patch for it. There's no way to just, you know, rewrite a couple lines of code and it's, you know, we're back in business. It's architecturally flawed, and to go back and fix it all breaks 100 other things that have been built on top of it. And, you know, that's bad.
Yeah, yeah. The internet, everybody.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Look what we built.
In only 30 years or whatever it's been.
Yeah, I mean, not even, right? I mean, the 25 roughly, which, you know, sort of shows kind of the amazing ability of these folks, and also the just kind of the ad hoc way that the thing was built to begin with.
Yeah, and the speed it moves at, too. I mean, it's no, like, no wonder, no other industry, I'm sure, in history.
Yeah, oh, for sure, yep. So the other thing that sort of, you know, hit me over the head at Black Hat was some of the mobile stuff that guys were doing. Like, you were writing a story, I think today or yesterday, on, like, a cellular IDS,
yeah.
Which I don't think was from Black Hat.
It was presented at DEF CON over the weekend.
Okay.
Yeah. But so basically, these researchers took one of these femtocells, which are kind of like a signal booster that, you know, you would use if you live in some remote location, or if you have a small office that, you know, you're not too close to a cell tower, you need a kind of a boost. And basically they figured a way to redirect mobile traffic through this femtocell before it hits the carrier. And then they're writing snort rules. They set up a server with running snort, and they wrote some custom snort rules to look at that mobile traffic before it hits the carrier and figure out if there's anything funky going on in terms of malware or in terms of a malicious app. And it's basically kind of just a way to look at mobile traffic, because all of it moves through the carriers, and it's really difficult to find out if anything malicious is going on once it gets to that point. It's basically game over.
Yeah, and that's cool. I mean, there's a lot of interesting mobile stuff going on. Like, I went to a talk by this guy, Ralph Philip Weinman, who did a talk on the BlackBerry 10 security model, which is pretty interesting because that's they introduced this thing in BlackBerry 10 that's kind of a partition between, like, your work data and your personal data. And it's, you know, nothing moves between the two,
right.
and each partition is encrypted separately. And, you know, I think it's a pretty cool idea. But he kind of looked at it and was like, you know, as a security feature, this doesn't give me a lot of, a lot of warm, fuzzy feelings, because I don't think people are going to use it correctly and people are going to get lazy. And then he showed this this feature called Quip, which is essentially a logging mechanism that will log a huge amount of your activity on the phone and just ship it back to BlackBerry. It's turned off by default, and the user really has to go in and, you know, you have to explicitly go in and know, you know, purposely turn it on and say, okay, log my voice calls, log this, log that, and yes, please send it to BlackBerry. So it's not like it's some hidden thing that, you know, BlackBerry put in there, you know, surreptitiously and is silently gathering all this data on people. It's essentially a diagnostic tool. But the fact that those kind of things are showing up on devices now, even though they're turned off by default, is a little worrisome to me.
Because it's definitely going to make people queasy at this point, especially what's going on now in the last few months.
Right. And with, like, the carrier IQ thing a while ago, which is completely different, you know, that was the carriers, and it, you know, it was done under the covers and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's not a huge number of steps between having it on there and deciding, okay, we're going to turn it on, but tell people that it's on, and then, you know, whatever. There's a lot of data collection going on that people probably aren't paying a lot of attention to.
Yeah, I mean, the whole mobile thing is really scary, especially when, you know, you mentioned the carriers and they're hesitant to push updates and to push patches. I mean, that came up again around the master key vulnerability where, you know, the patch was sent out and then it kind of falls into a black hole with some carriers and some handset makers. Nobody's really sure whether their phone is patched for it or not, and even though the patch is out there and, you know, was reverse engineered fairly quickly, so it's really ugly with the mobile stuff. And actually, I'm kind of surprised there wasn't more mobile stuff at Black Hat this year. It seemed to be kind of quiet. Maybe it was just some of the guys that didn't get to present this year.
That might be it. Yeah, there was a couple years there where it was, you know, there was a ton of mobile, you know, it was like 30 or 40% of the tracks.
Right.
It seems
like. Yeah, not long ago, yeah.
Maybe it just sort of hit a wall and, you know, there's not that much more that you can do on iOS, that's for sure, because the thing's closed and, you know, they actively discourage any sort of research on iOS, and Android's kind of been, you know, beaten over the head for the last couple of years. So I guess now you have people looking at BlackBerry and that sort of thing. But, it does feel like that stuff has reached some sort of threshold with the mobile research. I don't know what's next for that. But I also didn't see a ton of, you know, and I know Black Hat has traditionally been an offensive conference, but there's been some pretty good defensive talks in the past. I didn't really see too many at all this year. You know, nobody with, like, novel, you know, defensive techniques or, you know, ways to defend against this kind of attack or that kind of attack. I didn't really see anybody writing about that kind of stuff, did you?
No, I didn't either. the closest we got was just some offline discussions with some folks from Microsoft about the bug bounty and what's happening there, which last year they had the Blue Hat Prize, and I don't think they did anything similar to this year, although they may be ramping that up in another area. But yeah, you're right. It's the nature of Black Hat is totally offensive anyway, but there's usually a couple of interesting talks about some defensive strategies and technologies, but that was definitely missing this year.
Yeah. I wonder if, you know, if a year from now we're going to see a whole bunch of sort of anti-surveillance type talks. You know, here's how to avoid, like, here's a whole bunch of tools and techniques to use to avoid the NSA and that kind of thing.
Yeah, that would seem natural. You know, it depends on how sensitive companies are to that. I mean, a lot of companies just maybe focusing in other areas, and it just doesn't make business sense for them. But
right.
But yeah, I would think that'd be a natural progression in terms of what we might see in the next 6 months or so. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I saw a story. I think it was yesterday, and I apologize. I don't remember who had written it. It might have been CNET. I can't remember. But they had a quote from Nico Sell, who you know used to run press at Black Hat.
Yeah.
And that works as part of that startup Wicker that has sort of a silent circle-ish secure texting and phone app. And she said that they had been approached by the FBI to put a backdoor in their app, and they told them to buzz off, which is pretty interesting to me.
Yeah.
It's not surprising that they would have said no thank you. It's interesting how sort of brazen that stuff is.
Yeah, I bet it happens a lot, too. You just don't hear people coming forward the way she may have yesterday, but yeah, that's definitely interesting. I would love to know how much that's happening. Probably a lot more than we realize. And it takes some guts to say no. I mean, they approach you.
Yeah.
I would imagine you feel compelled, whether you're totally against it or not. It's just kind of hard to think.
That's the thing. Yeah, I think a bunch of guys in blue suits show up and ask you to do something like that. Your natural tendency, depending on, you know, your background, is probably going to be to say, okay, you know, it's the FBI, we should probably do what they say. But I went to a session, I think on the second day, that was about, on this issue, about legal access and, you know, lawful intercept and, like, sort of what your options are if the government shows up knocking on the door and asking you to do some of this stuff. And it was interesting. They had a guy from the Internet Archives who had been served with a national security letter about 5 years ago, I think, and he had no idea what a national security letter was or what his options were, and the FBI was looking for some data on one or a handful of his users and what their search history was on his site. And him and the EFF ended up suing the federal government, challenging this thing. And eventually the FBI sort of relented and said, okay, fine, we don't want this data. And he said, okay, great, but that's not the end of it. I want permission to, you know, I want this gag order lifted so that I can sort of write out a cookbook for other people on how to challenge these things in the future, because nobody knows that they can do this. You know, like, nobody challenges these. They just show up and, you know, they say okay. So he actually got permission to do that, which he did. And they had a couple of other speakers on the panel as well, Matt Blaze from the University of Pennsylvania and other people, who said, you have options. Like, you can challenge these things, especially if somebody shows up and wants to put, you know, a piece of monitoring equipment in your data center or something like that. And if they don't have a court order, you know, you can challenge this stuff. You don't have to just say yes. You know, and a lot of times they'll either back down or, you know, you'll get some sort of concessions.
Right.
You know, people just don't. They don't think about that, or they just sort of get intimidated.
Yeah, you've got to think it's pretty intimidating once one of these things arrives at your doorstep. And you know, your first inclination is not to challenge it. It's, you know, to figure out what you have to do to comply. And, you know, it takes somebody like that to kind of set the bar and say, you know, you don't have to do it, and here's why, and here's how. And that, you know, it's pretty cool that he got permission to talk about it, and, you know, that they didn't try to gag him even further.
Yeah, apparently he's one of three people who got that permission in the history of these things. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's, you know, and he had the actual national security letter up on the screen and all that, and it's super intimidating. Like it's basically, you know, in the last sentence is like, you may not discuss this with anyone else, or you know, under penalty of, you know, death by fire, right, or whatever.
And they're pretty specific too. I mean, like, you can't talk to your mother, you can't talk to your wife, your kid. They lay it out. It's not.
Yeah, like he wasn't even allowed to talk to the board of directors, right, about it. He could only talk to his lawyers at the EFF, you know, in like a closed room. Yeah. And there was actually a sentence in the letter, which was from the FBI, saying, because of security concerns, do not discuss this with the FBI over the phone.
How ironic.
Right. Which is maybe the best line ever in one of these things. Right. It's fantastic. And that was 5 years ago before any of this stuff was known.
Oh, it was great. That far back, huh?
Yep. Obviously, the FBI knew what was going on.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. So even the FBI assumes that they're being surveilled. So all in all, I think, you know, I feel like this is definitely one of the better. I think this is maybe the 12th or 13th year I've been at Black Hat, and I feel like it was one of the better two or three that I've been to. You know, there's been some down years when it was, you know, a little slower and the economy wasn't great, so a lot of people weren't going and whatever. But they had some fantastic talks this year. I think they've worked out a lot of like the logistical and organizational bugs that they had in recent years. I definitely got a lot out of it. I thought they did an excellent job.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's definitely something to be said for a lack of hype and lack of this big splashy talk. I mean, aside from Alexander, it really wasn't, you know, that one thing you had to kind of shoot for to, you know, that must attend session. And a lot of it was really deep and applicable to what's going on today. It wasn't, you know, it was definitely one of the better shows I've been to. It's been, you know, this is like 8 or 9 for me. And definitely the last couple of years, this definitely stands out.
Yeah, you're right. I feel like the lack of that one sort of like overriding talk where everybody's like, you know, you're lined up an hour ahead of time and that kind of garbage, and you know that everybody's going to write the same exact story when we all walk out of there. Like, that actually helps it. Like, I'd much rather have, you know, 6 or 8, you know, really interesting things than one like super hyped, you know, like hotel lockpicking thing or, you know,
right,
something along those lines.
Those never live up to the expectations anyway. It's kind of like the Super Bowl. It's fun getting.
Yeah. Yeah. You're really just there for the drinks at some point then. Yeah. All right. Cool. So hopefully we'll. This will be the first of a series of these. I don't want to overpromise, but given our schedules, but we're going to try and do it every couple weeks and sort of summarize what's happened on the interwebs in that time. So
sounds
I think
good.
We're off to a good start.
Definitely.
All right, man. I will talk to you soon.
All righty. Bye.
See ya.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Compliments of Kaspersky Lab, a world leader in internet threat protection for small, medium, and large enterprises. Visit Kaspersky.com for more information about their line of premium protection solutions.